Which brings us to our last topic, and the issue of same-gender attraction. So, we've now, everyone has the same sheets, it's all, the sheets are, you know, include both topics. We've established the basic aspects of Jewish love and marriage. We talked about procreation, we talked about growing as ethical, spiritual individuals. We talked about the rituals and commitment that are introduced to make marriage a durable and safe environment. We talked about divorce, when the desires, the desire for marriage or the functionality of the marriage breaks down. And that brings us to the last topic. So someone this morning asked me, as I was leaving the Beit Midrash to come here, why I do this to myself. Why did I... why do I want to do that? My goal here is not to convince anyone of anything. My goal here is not to sell anything. Although I will note that there are flyers around for the Beit Midrash dinner. My goal is really to convey two points. Number one, that the traditional position, and I don't like using the word orthodox, particularly when you deal with this issue on which the lines are blurry between different groups, but the traditional position is not born of homophobia. It's born of a coherent theory of relationships and marriage, and reasonable people can debate it, but it's about a view of how relationships and marriage work. That's point number one that I want to get across. And then point number two, speaking from the perspective of traditional Judaism, is that there's nothing wrong with, there is nothing deviant about, there is nothing evil in somebody who is gay. Whether they're living that lifestyle, not living that lifestyle, whatever it is, I know full well that there are those who are traditional, who have said it, but I don't believe that that expresses truth about Torah and truth about what traditional Judaism has had to say. And we're going to see, both of these points in the course of the conversation. If anyone needs to leave early because, you know, we had planned originally as an hour-long session, you know, you'll get the link for it. I'm not offended, and I apologize for not being able to get everything in less time, but this is just what we have. I want to start with source number 8. This goes back to April 2001. It's an article, as you see, called Gay and Orthodox from Moment Magazine. And this goes back to the release of a movie called Trembling Before God. How many of you are familiar with the film?
Yeah.
It's a very interesting movie. I was a rabbi in Pennsylvania at the time that it came out, and I ended up doing the speaking circuit, you know, where people would watch the movie, and then the last person they wanted to hear from was an Orthodox rabbi. Or maybe they wanted to throw rocks. But it was an important movie. And that's what you're going to see here in the article, because it told the world something that many people either did not know or did not want to know, which is that there are an awful lot of people who are believing and practicing observant Jews who are gay and who are trying to figure out what that means and what life should be like for them. Take a look at this paragraph from the article. You can find the full article online. Later this year, with the release of the documentary film Trembling Before God, the painful lives of gay Orthodox Jews will play out unflinchingly on movie screens nationwide. And with this exposure comes the growing realization by gay Orthodox Jews that there are others like them out there. 5 years ago, when three gay Orthodox friends founded a support group called the Gay and Lesbian Yeshiva Day School Alumni Association, Glitza, okay, Orthodox homosexuals were much more isolated. Gay Orthodox people didn't exist in the eyes of the Orthodox world then, says Chaim, a New York area professional who was at the group's first meeting. If you didn't know any other gay Orthodox Jews, you carried around this really dark secret. Today, says Chaim, all of that is changing. The underground community is growing, allowing gay Orthodox Jews to associate with each other. We come from all kinds of families and all kinds of backgrounds, Chaim says. We are everywhere. So, number one, that's something that in 2001 became much better known, but it's still evolving. you can't fool yourself into thinking there was this epiphany in 2001, and then, you know, suddenly the world became more accepting and everybody became more understanding. And this is still a community, meaning the traditional community, is still a community that is struggling with this and how to deal with it. When you're talking about a community that places tremendous emphasis on marriage and having children, right, the two going very much together in the mind of this community, you know, even the most basic thing, a single man, a single woman moves into the community, and it's not long before people who are very well-meaning will approach them and say, you know, I know just the girl for you, I know just the guy for you. And, you know, they're thinking to themselves, I wish people would leave me alone. And they don't know how to deal with this in a way that will be socially acceptable. Right? To say, actually, I'm not interested in guys, I'm not interested in girls, can bring them a whole lot of trouble that they just don't want. A whole lot of discomfort.
They're not necessarily gay. They're not necessarily.
That's also true. That's also true. But in the case of people who are, it can be uncomfortable for people who just aren't looking. Yeah, that's for sure true. But very well-meaning people who think that what they're doing is a kindness and think that what they're doing can be the best favor you can do for somebody, you're setting them up with a person who's going to be their soulmate for life, can actually be causing somebody tremendous anxiety and a feeling of being an outcast within the community. This is a real challenge. Parents who, you know, always assumed that they're going to have kids and they're going to have grandchildren and you know, even judge their personal success at raising their children based on whether they're going to have grandchildren, discover that it's not so simple and not so straightforward. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. I'm just, you know, playing out why this is such a challenge for a community that really should be aware by now. The classic number that's quoted in society is that 10% of society is gay. You know, whether that number is accurate or not, call it 7% if you like, call it 13%, doesn't really matter. Right? The point is that it isn't zero. Right? And for a community that is millions of people, that's an awful lot of people who don't fit into what you're thinking of as the standard paradigm, and you have to figure out, so what are we doing for them? How do we, you know, how do we deal with this? Take a look at number 9, though, because the Trembling Before God movie was biased towards a recognition of people who are gay and living a gay lifestyle within the Orthodox community one way or another. In secret or whatever, but that was the slant of the movie, to interview people who are actually living that way. And there was a backlash. You see it here in number 9, an article from Jewish Action. Jewish Action is the magazine of the Orthodox Union. The article is titled Unsung Heroes, which already tells you where it's going. The problem with Trembling is not so much what it shows as what it leaves out. Where are the stories of those who don't act on their homosexual attractions, those who simply feel that sexual desire is not a license to violate a divine imperative? Aren't their struggles powerful and inspiring as well? Here again, the liberal mantra of diversity and inclusion does not apply to those who strive to adhere to the halakha, to Jewish law. Yes?
At the beginning of the movie, though, the rabbi that they interview and a couple people, they did strive to adhere to Jewish law. And we do meet them. We do talk to Rabbi, or whatever his name was, Vance.
Yeah.
And the psychologist.
That doesn't come off very well in the movie.
But he tried. He did
try
to live as a Jewish, the Torah life, and the psychologist who was married and had 5 children. He did try, so this article is not.
No, but the bulk of the movie is
to give it credit.
What Diane is talking about is something else that's very significant that I'm not going to go into in great depth. But at least I should note, with the rubber bands, if for anyone who saw the film, it's a fellow who's undergoing conversion therapy. So he's told that whenever he has a thought of this, he should snap this rubber band on his wrist. I am not an advocate of conversion therapy. There are too many horror stories. I'm not a psychologist, but there are too many horror stories and too many suicides that are attributed to this for me to think that this is something I could recommend in good conscience. But let's talk about where this comes from.
One question regarding the abhorrence when the woman can't stand to be with the husband because he disgusts her. So, but that line, then he fall into this concerned that the other, whoever it is, you know...
It can. It certainly can, yes. Where the woman, in the course of the marriage, decides, maybe she knew before, maybe she did not know before, that she's not attracted to men, and therefore he's repellent to her, then yes, the protocol that we saw when we discussed divorce is going to come into play, absolutely. So, realistically, the stance of traditional Jewish law is painfully clear. And I didn't want to bring you a sheet of sources. I brought you the simple verse back from Leviticus in source number 10, the one that for some reason some of the evangelical Christian churches have decided they're going to pick out of Leviticus and observe and drop, you know, the whole rest of the book. And with a male you shall not live as you live with a woman. It is addressed to a man saying not to live with a man as he would live with a woman. That's a polite translation. Lo sishkav is really to lie with. It is toeva. The word toeva is a word I'm going to come back to. And this has been responded to by different groups in different ways, meaning the response of Reform is to say, well, this is a human-generated verse reflecting the values of that moment in human history, and therefore, once humanity has moved past it, it's no longer binding. Conservative Judaism has a range of approaches, from a left-wing side that's very similar to the Reform stance that says this simply isn't relevant today, it's a human verse, to a right-wing that's much, much, much closer to where Orthodoxy ends up.
What's a human verse?
Human-authored verse. It was written by human beings. But within Orthodoxy, traditionally, there is a central tenet that says that you're not free to write off a verse as being human in origin. It doesn't work that way. This was brought in the Talmud, the volume of Sanhedrin, page 54. The Rambam Maimonides in his Mishneh Torah. It's brought in Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. There was no debate historically about how to explain this verse. You know, I've heard people say, well, you know, a man can't physically lie with a man as he would lie with a woman, so it can't be referring to sexual relationships between males. It's a nice try, but it doesn't fit the historical read of the sentence in any way. What this doesn't do, I should make very clear, is that it doesn't ban close friendship. It doesn't ban desires. Right? It bans a specific sexual interaction. And I think that's something that, you know, a point that often gets missed, but it matters. But having said that, this is a serious prohibition in terms of the way that we normally grade prohibitions in the Torah. Meaning, you know, what's your basis normally for deciding that a biblical prohibition is more serious or less serious? What's your standard? How do you decide that Shabbat is more serious than not wearing a garment with wool and linen mixed together in it? What's your basis?
Yeah. How many times it's mentioned?
How many times it's mentioned in the Torah? That's a possibility, right? So we have certain mitzvot that make it into the Torah repeatedly. Honesty and justice, for example, appears over and over and over again. Sexual prohibitions tend to appear twice in the Torah, both times in the book of Leviticus, veiled reference in Deuteronomy, perhaps. That would be one. Well, the word toiva I'm going to come back to, because that's its own...
It's a bad thing. It's like worse than bad.
Maybe. Maybe not.
How important is the functioning of a Jewish society?
So that's already a subjective read. I'm asking for it's important, but I'm looking first at the objective elements within the text itself that will tell you. I think the penalty that's listed, right? Meaning, sometimes you'll get a text that will say, this is prohibited, whereas sometimes you'll get a text that will say, and there's a death penalty for it, right? Generally speaking, keeping in mind that the death penalty from a Jewish law perspective is extraordinarily difficult to carry out. Because you require two witnesses who give a warning before the action, who actually see the warning, circumstantial evidence, see the event, circumstantial evidence is thrown out, who give the warning, and then the person says to them, I know, and I'm doing it on that condition. And then you have a court of 23 judges whose mission is actually stated in the Torah as, you shall save the defendant. That's their job. Such that if they vote 23-0 to convict, then the case is thrown out because they clearly didn't try hard enough, and they're not going to be able to see merit for the defendant. It's very hard to carry out a death penalty in Jewish law. Not to mention, I mean, our courts anyway. We don't have the courts that could do it. But even historically, you know, the classic line that gets quoted is the line of the sage 2,000 years ago who said that he was right after the court stopped doing this, but he said, had I been on such a court, they never would have carried out a death penalty. There's another line that doing it once in 70 years already shows that the court is bloodthirsty. The message of a death penalty in the biblical text is not a prescription of do this. It's a statement of this really matters to God. That's what it's conveying, in hierarchy of values. And this one, unfortunately, is listed with that. So you have to know that that's one of the reasons why it's taken so seriously. There was a hand here.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, isn't that death penalty interpreted as sort of a spiritual death?
So there's a separate punishment called karet, which is spiritual, a spiritual cutting off, so to speak. There's no court administered punishment, but that's not true for this one. Yeah, that's not in this case. Another example of a distinction between levels of prohibition would be a sin of commission versus a sin of omission, meaning a mitzvah lo taseh, a prohibition, don't do X, is considered to be more severe than a mitzvah asay, a mitzvah of go do Y. So eating non-kosher is worse than failing to take a lulav on Sukkot, as an example. Awareness, intentional sin versus accidental sin. Intentional is worse than accidental. Public versus private. Sins that are public have an element of desecration of God's name and the honor of the Torah, whereas something that's done in private is considered to be less severe. We have all sorts of different ways of grading prohibitions, and when you apply them to this, because you have the death penalty listed, because you have it as a sin of commission, you're doing something as opposed to just omission, because it's mentioned a couple of times in the Torah, because of the issue of it being something that people are aware of, there's an intentional element to it, it is considered to be very significant. Now, I should note at some point, so I might as well now, that technically speaking, this verse in number 10 is addressing the male. The prohibition for women is popularly understood to be a rabbinic prohibition as opposed to a biblical prohibition. There's rabbinic discussion about it, because why not? But generally speaking, the view that's brought in Maimonides is the view that for women it's a rabbinic prohibition. Now here I want to come back to the word that Diane pointed out in the sentence, which is the word to'eva, which I deliberately did not translate in source number 10. How do we usually hear people translate the word to'eva? Abomination, right? Abomination is the word that people commonly use. King James did us no favors. The word in Hebrew is to'eva, but it's really important to understand what the word to'eva means and does not mean. The Talmud itself, in source number 11, says the word to'eva should be rendered as a contraction of three words. This is not a rigorous scholarly etymology of the word, but it is what the Talmud wants to explain the word to mean. To'eva, it renders as to'eh ata ba. Now this is to'eh with a tav, not to'eh with a tet. For those who are Hebrew speakers, there's an important distinction. To'eh with a tet means mistaken. To make a mistake. A ta'ut is a mistake. To'eh with a tav means to wander. Stray. So, for example, when Joseph goes looking for his brothers, he can't find them. A man found him, and he was wandering in the field. He didn't know where to go. So, to'eh ataba means you are wandering with this. You are straying with this. Which, to me, emphasizes that what the Talmud is trying to say is that this is a desire. That somebody is following, which the Torah has already told me should not be followed. You're not supposed to go after it, but it's a basic elemental human desire, not something where the person is evil and lashing out and doing something that you would classify as, to use the term, abominable. That's number one. Number two is that it's very important to know that the word toiva is used in the Torah for all sorts of practices. Far from this one. Far from homosexuality. And I say this not to reduce one's sensitivity to anything that the Torah labels toiva, but rather to get a framework for where does the Torah use this word. So here's the list. I wanted to include it on here. I tried to keep everything to one page, so I ended up not including it. But if anybody really wants, I can send them this list later. I'm going to give you the biblical verses now. The list that I'm going to bring you, all of these are Deuteronomy. Chapter 7, sentence 26 uses it for idolatry. And that's the most common use of the term toeva, leading some to actually suggest that one of the concerns was for idolatrous rituals that involved homosexual activity. Who knows? But Deuteronomy 14, sentence 3, uses it for non-kosher food. Chapter 7, maybe they're serving Big Macs at the idol, I don't know. Chapter 17, sentence 1, uses it for bringing an inappropriate sacrifice to God. Chapter 22, sentence 5, uses it for cross-dressing. Chapter 23, sentence 8, uses it to refer generically to anything that you exclude, that you stay away from, is toeva. It is excluded. Chapter 24, sentence 4, uses it for remarrying one's divorced spouse after they marry, for a man to remarry one's divorced wife, specifically, after she married somebody else. So in other words, a man and woman were married, they got divorced, she married somebody else, that marriage ended, and then they want to get remarried, that's toeva. Why is a good question, but we already discussed divorce. We're done with that. It's a good question, but it requires really its own discussion about. I think it takes us back to the discussion about grounds for divorce and concern for serial marriage. I think that's the concern that they have is that you can end up with a promiscuous situation in which, sure, we'll get married now, and then we'll get divorced, and then marry this one, and then get divorced, and so on. Chapter 25, sentence 16, uses toeva for dishonest weights and measures. You cheat people in your store, right, with the scale. That's also toeva. So, look, none of these are good things, right, from the Torah's perspective. All of them are prohibited. But this is why I react uncomfortably to the word abomination, because I think it has all sorts of overtones that people would not apply to non-kosher food. I wish that people would apply abomination to, dishonesty in business. And hopefully people do. But it's important to recognize what this word means in Torah. It's very hard to assign it a one-size-fits-all definition other than to say that which is, that which you are supposed to exclude. But going back to the term to'a'atava that the Talmud uses, what the Talmud is trying to tell me is that this is an act of straying after one's desire and leaving the home that you ought to have, leaving the family that you're meant to build. And that's the idea here. But here's where things, I think, have to come back to the philosophical issues that we've discussed in terms of marriage and relationship. It's entirely possible, as I said at the outset, for Judaism to recognize this as a natural form of love and not something that is deviant, and it could even be biological. I don't want to get into the scientific debate. I'm not a neurologist. I've read the same things that you've read, about the structure of different parts of the brain, and I'm willing to stipulate for the sake of discussion that for some people who identify as homosexual, it's actually biological. It's not something learned. It's not something that they chose. It's not something where they were raised a certain way and they didn't have a strong father in the home or all the other explanations that people give. That for some of the people who live this lifestyle, it's actually biological. I'm good with that idea. Good, for two of us. And that a person who is gay is not, you know, deviant or defective. Take a look at source number 12. This is from a very important article, important to me at any rate, 1995, in a journal called Tradition, called Initial Religious Counseling for a Male Orthodox Adolescent Homosexual. And this is the paragraph that I'm taking from the article. The whole article is worth reading. It's available for free online. It is interesting to speculate why the Torah stresses that homosexual acts are an, quote, abomination, along with the other prohibited abominable sexual acts, just as it labels unkosher food abominations. So it's interesting to speculate about this word toeva. But that is neither here nor there. The Torah forbids these because they are quite normal, but in the Torah's view, improper. Sometimes we can understand the reason for a prohibition. Indeed, the argument against homosexuality is as cogent as that in support of kashrut. But whether or not we understand the rationale of a specific prohibition, we can assume that any Torah prohibition implies that it is something which is part of the common human situation that is being prohibited. In other words, if this wasn't something that was a normal desire, you wouldn't need a prohibition in the Torah to say, don't do it. Now, kashrut itself is subject to a lot of speculation. Why is it that the Torah says, God made this and God made that, but this I can eat and that I can't eat? We've discussed it in other occasions. But the argument they're presenting is that this is going to be rejected, but it doesn't mean that the person involved is defective. Saying something is biological does not necessarily mean that it is mandatory. And I think that's an important point that people need to think about. Homosexual does not mean for everybody incapable of being attracted to somebody of the opposite gender. In 1948, right, Kinsey introduces his scale of sexual attraction, right? The 0 to 6 scale. People are familiar with this? He introduces a scale from 0 to 6. In which one end of the scale, I forget which one was 0 and which one was 6, but one end of the scale is 100% heterosexual and the other end of the scale is 100% homosexual. And many people have desires in both directions. There was a study done in 2015 using this scale, like Butterfew in number 13. With each generation, people see their sexuality as less fixed in stone. The results for 18 to 24-year-olds are particularly striking. 43% place themselves in the non-binary area between 1 and 5, meaning, I'm not all this, I'm not all that. 52% place themselves at one end or the other. Of the 52% who place themselves at one end or the other, only 46% say they are completely heterosexual and 6% as completely homosexual. So it's not 46% of those, sorry. On the overall scale, 46% say they are completely heterosexual, 6% say they're completely homosexual, and everybody else is somewhere in between. There's a very interesting book by a fellow by the name of Eric Marcus. It's called Is It a Choice? In which he lists all sorts of questions that people have about this, and he's very forthright in saying that the fact that somebody is homosexual does not necessarily mean that they can't be attracted to somebody of the opposite gender. Let me be very clear, though, about what I'm suggesting here. My point is absolutely not to suggest that people should be forced into relationships that they don't want. That you have somebody who feels homosexual attraction, but, you know, too bad. We're going to say, well, you could be attracted to a woman, so now we're going to force you to do so. My point is simply to say that even if you say it is biological, that does not automatically translate to, and therefore incapable of, a relationship with anybody else. The two are not the same. Next point within this is that the fact that something is natural doesn't necessarily mean that Judaism is going to have to say it's acceptable. The argument has been made. You know, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, who was the chancellor of Yeshiva University, my alma mater, made this argument. You're familiar with Encyclopedia Judaica? So in their yearbook in 1974, he wrote an article called Judaism and a Modern Attitude to Homosexuality, in which he made the argument that this is what is called ones for some people who are homosexual. The word ones means what? Well, in the Torah's context, it's used in a particular way, but the word itself means to be compelled. It's used in the sense of rape in one particular case within the Torah, but in general, the term ones is used to refer to compulsion. And he makes the argument that for some people who are homosexual, who would face a severe internal imbalance if they were to not have any outlet, the argument may well be made. But even without that ones exemption, my belief is one which I think many people will disagree with me on, so go for it. But my belief is that God may well put a person in a position in which that person will desire to do something that is prohibited. Or to put it differently, there is such a thing as a test that you can't pass. I've always heard people say, since I was a little kid, that God doesn't give you a test that you can't pass. If this is, you know, your situation, you have to be able to... it must be that there's a way for you to beat it, right? You've heard this idea before?
Yeah.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that is entirely possible that a person is put in a situation in which they can't pass the test. There is a passage in the Talmud which says, "Eina kadosh baruch hu ba betrunya imbriyosa," which means that God does not look to make things difficult for his creatures. God isn't looking just to give you a hard time. But I don't think you have to assume that a test you can't pass equals God giving you a hard time. The test may be how well you deal with it, not did you actually succeed in passing it, so to speak, by engaging in this or not engaging in that. Moshe.
That's what I don't understand.
Yeah.
Are you saying that therefore, on a certain level, it would be okay for that person to not pass the test, or must the person pass the test? I don't understand what you're saying.
Right. So the answer. I'm going to get. Let me do two sources first, and then I'm going to answer your question. But I will answer it. The first source that I wanted to show you is source number 14. Source number 14, passage out of the Talmud, in which the sage declares, based on a verse, based on a word, the Torah uses the word vayitzer for the creation of human beings. But it uses two yuds. Vayitzer literally means, "and he formed." A yotzer is a potter or somebody who forms things. But it uses two letters yud, as you see in number 14. Indicating, as the Talmud reads it, to yitzrim. And your yetzer is your nature, that which you are formed with. We talk about a yetzer hatov and a yetzer hara, a good nature and a bad nature. But the way that this passage reads the line, I think it's Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi speaking there, he says, in Hebrew, oili mi yitzri, oili mi yotzri, which is nice poetry that totally doesn't come across in the English. Woe to me from my nature, my yetzer, and woe to me from my yotzer, my creator. In other words, I have a basic nature that pits me against my creator. It's basic to who I am. There is an idea that the person has something in their nature that wants to do and is driven to do something that the Torah says no about. That's a possibility. In a different session, I think I talked about Rabbi Leo Dessler. I talked about him actually earlier in this series for a different point. But he has a philosophy of free will in which he floats the idea that we don't have free will for most of the things we do. Because of various influences, whether the influences are biological or communal, you know, there are any number of things that lead us in different directions, but he argues that actually, for many of the things that we do or don't do, the decision is not one we make from moment to moment, but it's a decision that's already been made years ago. Yeah. So you have a child who grows up in a home in which people gossip. That's just what they do. It's normal. His parents do it. It's what he sees at the table when they're eating their meals. That child, when that child grows up and has conversations with people, is also going to gossip. That's a terrible prohibition. The Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, you talked about how many times something is listed in the Torah, identifies 31 separate prohibitions against speaking negatively about other people. 31.
twins would be a good example. The twins who have been separated, and you'll find when they get together after many years, they are doing the same things. They marry the same kind of people. That's the exact
right. So you can have that in terms of biological influence.
Yes.
But the point that Rabbi Dessler is trying to make is that for this kid, when there's a conversation, he has the opportunity to say something wrong about somebody else. He doesn't even think twice. It's not. There's no choice being made. And then on the other hand, you have people who do things that are good, not because they've thought it through, but because also this is the environment in which they grew up. So you'll find somebody who is philanthropic, not because they ever thought about it, but because that's their instinct, because that's what's, you know, been what they've lived in. Sorry? What's been modeled for them. And that's, you know, for them it's not a big challenge. There's a middle point between the two sides, which are the areas in which it's actually a struggle. We have to stop and think, am I going to do it? Am I not going to do it? But what he's saying, what he's recognizing, is that there are indeed natural influences that will push a person against what the Torah wants him to do, or at least says he wants him to do. And then take a look at number 15, Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin. He refers to a passage in the Talmud. I'm going to give you the passage actually first, and then we'll read the source, because otherwise the line won't make any sense. The Jews in the wilderness stand at Sinai and hear God speak to Moshe, to Moses, right? You get the Ten Commandments, the first two directly from God, the latter eight seem to be Moses speaking to the nation, but they have this big sound and light show. The next day, Moses disappears up the mountain without telling them when he's coming down. There's a midrash that they know that it's supposed to be 40 days. Fine. The simple read of the text is that they don't know. But either way, they're standing there at the mountain, you know, tapping their feet. Okay, now what? Well, we wait, I guess. And a day goes by, and another day goes by, and another day goes by, and they have no idea what's happened. Finally, 40 days go by, and they go back to Aaron and say, you know, he's gone. He's not gone. He didn't bring food up the mountain. There's nothing up there. You know, can you bring us another one? Because remember, Aaron brought them Moses in the first place, out of the wilderness in Egypt. So they say, yeah, we lost him. Can you bring us another? They have all this gold. So that Moses actually, as the Talmud reads it, turns to God after the golden calf and says, what did you expect was going to happen? You gave them all this gold. You abandoned them at the mountain. And he makes an analogy. He says, he compares it to a young man who is dressed up in finery, he's perfumed, and he has beautiful clothing, and they give him a bag of gold, and they hang it around his neck, and they bring him to the bad part of town, and just leave him outside a building, and the building being, you know, a brothel, and he says, like, what did you think was going to happen? And that's what he references here in source number 15. Sometimes a person will face a test which is so great that it is impossible for him not to sin. It is as the sages said, what could the boy do to avoid sinning? Like, what did you think was going to happen? You can go back further in history to Adam and Eve in the garden, right? The nicest tree in the garden, right in the middle, right? What did you think was going to happen? To which the answer is, the test is not whether you succeeded in fulfilling the divine commandment or not. The test is, what did you do with this? How hard did you try? Where was your heart in this? And now go back to Moshe's excellent question from before. Does that mean that it's okay? So my answer is to cheat. I'm cheating the question. No, not to cheat that way. My answer is to cheat the question and to say it is entirely possible that this is actually beyond his ability to pass. But we never know whether it is beyond our ability to pass, and therefore the person is expected to do his best, to do her best, recognizing that if they fail, that doesn't mean, and I'm going to come back to this point shortly, that doesn't mean they're a horrible human being. That doesn't mean that they are now written off. They're expected to do the best they can with the hand they've been dealt. That's the, you know, that's the expectation. I'm going to come back to this in greater depth in a minute. But I want to first, yeah,
but the other thing is that you can't judge them when they act in a homosexual way, because the test and the struggle would not be known to you.
Right.
It would be known to God.
Correct.
And so I think it provides the opportunity to not
Right. So I'm going to come back to that also. But I have a whole section of this about what is expected of the person who has the attraction and what is expected of the community around them. So we're going to come back to that. But first I wanted to go back to our whole point that we've been developing over the last few weeks, because I think it's very relevant here in terms of same-gender attraction. We talked about the two goals, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. The goal in Genesis 2 is ethical growth. For the person to grow to the point of Vayitzav, where they can have a command from God and fulfill it. And I think, you know, speaking of that and of a relationship which will lead to that, that doesn't require a man and a woman. That can happen with two men. The whole concept in yeshiva study of a chavruta, right, is not just somebody, you know, you sit across the table from and you read the Talmud together. But they're supposed to be helping each other in terms of their spiritual growth. That's what's supposed to happen. And you can point to examples of it biblically, David and Jonathan being one. I do not accept the modern rewrite of the story which reads it as sexual. I think that's, you know, wishful thinking. But there's clearly this kind of a close and righteous friendship between them. Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish in the Talmud, you can find numerous examples of it the further along you go in our history. I think that that part of it is possible. But the other goal, right, goal number one, so to speak, Genesis 1, is procreation. And we look at how important that is in terms of the way it's presented in the Torah. I gave you three verses in source number 16. The very first thing we know about God is that God is a creator of life. Right? In the beginning of God's creation of the heavens and the earth, .. The very first blessing that God gives is to the fish, bear fruit and multiply, fill the waters in the seas, and so on. The very first command that God gives to humanity is to produce life, bear fruit, multiply, fill the land. That's the very first thing that he says to us. The passage in the Talmud that describes the six questions that one will be asked after dying, right? We actually are given the exam questions in advance, right? So what's the first question? What's the first question of the six?
Why are you here?
No.
Do you have children?
Nope. The first question is, Nasata v'natata be'emunah. Did you deal honestly in business? That's your first question that you're asked. Your second. God grades on a curve. Some of you have failed that one. The second question is, did you set aside time to study Torah? Did you have fixed times to study Torah? But as you go along in the questions, you then get to Asakta Bipiria Verivia. Did you involve yourself in trying to procreate? Note that the emphasis is not, did you procreate? Because there are people, again, for whom this is not a possibility. But did you try? And trying may mean adoption. Trying may mean funding adoption. There are all sorts of ways in which one can enable procreation, and this is a value that is big enough that it makes it into the top six questions. This is something that is considered to be very, very significant. And if you take a look at source number 17, Rabbi Aaron Halevi, who is assumed to be the author of the Sefer HaChinuch, was written anonymously, but the Sefer HaChinuch goes through the 613 mitzvot as he lists them and tries to explain each of them. And on the prohibition against homosexual relations, he says, among the roots of this mitzvah, he never says this is the root of the mitzvah, because he knows better than to say definitively, but he says, Mishorshei HaMitzvah, among the roots of this mitzvah, is this: God wishes the world he created to be settled. Therefore he commanded that they may not waste seed in homosexual relations, and so on. It's fundamentally a problem of procreation. Now, even if cloning would work out, or they would adopt, and you'll say, well, now we've solved that problem, right? Or on a more basic level, there's surrogacy, and which raises its own ethical questions for another time. But even should that work out, fundamentally, the relationship between these two people, the two men, the two women, would not be a procreative relationship. It's not as though the rule would suddenly change, the biblical text would suddenly no longer apply. And yes, it's true, again, that heterosexual marriages may not result in children, The truth of the matter is that the sages in the Talmud actually weighed in against intentionally creating relationships between either a young man and a woman who is no longer able to have children, or a young woman with a man who is no longer able to have children. So you find that discussed actually in that same source in number 17. So what you're talking about is, and this goes back to what I had said in the beginning, that what I wanted to convey is that this is part of a coherent philosophy of how relationships work. What you have is a relationship which could well satisfy the ethical growth aspect of it, but because it defies the procreative aspect, that's where you get this this prohibition. Now, everything I have said does not change the frustration that I have with this mitzvah. Meaning, the bottom line at the end of the day is, even if, you know, let's make up percentages, even if 90% of people who identify as homosexual are able to also have a heterosexual relationship, so that just means that there are 10% who can't. And when you consider, again, the standard number that people quote, 10% of society, so 10% of 10%, that means 1%, 1 in 100, right? 1 in 100, that means 10 in 1,000, right? That means 100 in 10,000. Your number keeps going up. It means that you have a significant number of people who would like to be able to follow the laws for something that they believe in, who have a problem. And even if I can understand the logic behind the law, that doesn't change the empathy that I would hope people would have, at least sympathy, if not empathy, for someone who, for someone who is living in pain. It should bother us tremendously. You know, as someone who believes in the broader picture of the Torah, it doesn't make me say, okay, so I'm dropping it. But this should trouble people. If it doesn't bother somebody, I am worried. I think that this is problematic. But I do think that it fits a broader picture, and it's not simply a knee-jerk, you know, reaction by a desert tribe, you know, conforming to the morals and ethics of the world in which they lived in at the time. I think that it is fundamentally it's fundamentally part of the Torah's logic. So what does the Torah expect of us? Going back to Nanette's point, and this question of how they'll be judged or looked upon. So first of all, I actually go back earlier to the point about the person who thinks of himself, who thinks of herself as having a same gender attraction. I go back to the point that I made in the beginning that the tradition article made in number 12, which is that this person has to know they're not defective, they're not crazy. They are created in the image of God, just like everybody else. They're dealing with a frightening challenge, and they're going to be respected for whatever they accomplish. The idea of them feeling the attraction is not a transgression in and of itself. It's the physical relationship that we're talking about. And this person must never, ever give up on his or her Judaism and his or her God, even if they don't succeed. Maimonides wrote what is an epic letter to the Jews of Morocco in the 12th century. Have we talked about this letter at any point? All right. This is an epic letter. The Jews of Morocco are living under the Almohads. The Almohads insisted that if you wanted to live in their country, meaning to remain in the country and to remain alive, you had to make a declaration accepting Muhammad. They didn't care if you practiced Judaism in private, according to Maimonides. They just wanted you to make this declaration. So a certain sage, whose name is lost to history, opened a letter to the community, saying, if you make that declaration, all of your mitzvot are now meaningless, are now worthless, all of your commandments, everything you do, go by the wayside. God is not interested in you anymore. That's it. It's over. And Maimonides writes a four-part letter, taking this fellow apart. I mean, literally, taking him apart. His first part is just insults. It would have been better that this guy didn't write anything in the first place, and so on and so on. He doesn't name the fellow. You sort of want to know, you sort of don't want to know. But then he moves on from that to attack the substance of this fellow's letter, and he spends quite a bit of time bringing examples from Tanakh and Talmud to show that even if a person fails, and fails miserably in certain areas of Jewish law, that doesn't mean that the good things they do are simply thrown out. And he brings you an example, a striking example, in source number 18. Ahav ben Omri. Ahav ben Omri was a king of Israel whose wife you've heard of. Even if you haven't heard of Ahab, you've heard of Jezebel. Jezebel is his wife. She's the one who murders hundreds of prophets. He's not exactly a prize either. But Ahav ben Omri, who denied God and worshipped idols, and about whom God testified that there was never another like Ahav, and not in a good way, he fasted for 2.5 hours when he was rebuked by Elijah. And then the sages taught the decree upon him, there was a decree against him, was voided. God did not cheat him of the reward. He got rewarded for the good things that he did. Even though he did terrible things, nonetheless, when he did something good, he was rewarded for it. So this person should never give up. This person also, I haven't said this yet, and I have to insert it somewhere, it doesn't really fit at this part, but I'm going to say it at this point. He should never, or she should never, marry someone of the opposite gender under false pretenses. Right? We've heard of such things happening. You can't do that. That's a terrible thing to do to another human being. You have to be honest. Whether it's, you know, if you have someone who thinks he can manage this and have this relationship, whether it's a thing he says before the first date is another story. But the other party has to be aware relatively early on so they're not wasting their time of the situation that they're in. There are cases, I know of cases, in which they decided that they were good with this. Sorry, Marilyn?
I'm saying immigrants that marry just to come.
No, that's an interesting analogy, marrying for a green card, so to speak. But that's in terms of what the Torah expects of this person. What does the Torah expect of the community? So here we have a really big challenge. The challenge is that Jews are commanded repeatedly in the Torah and in Talmud to right wrongs, to prevent transgression. We have a mitzvah of being a busybody. Right? Do not hate somebody in your heart. You shall educate them. Hocheach tochiach et amitecha. Show them what is right. Kol Yisrael arevin zevazeh. We are all guarantors for each other. And so on. At the same time, we are also commanded to protect people from harm and to protect them from shame. We have an important mitzvah of kvod habriyot, human dignity, which overrides all rabbinic law. Yeah, it's very clear in Jewish law that we have this very strong imperative of preventing sin. But how do you employ that when you also have this value of preserving people's dignity? So one argument is the argument that Rabbi Dr. Lamb brought, which I mentioned above, which is the argument of saying, well, you know what, they're forced into this, and therefore don't ostracize them, don't judge them, they're forced into it, and that's that. There is the argument which, frankly, I wouldn't accept, the argument of Tinok Shanishva. Tinok Shanishva is a category that's mentioned in the Talmud regarding people who are raised among non-Jews. In the case in the Talmud, it's somebody who was kidnapped as a child and therefore was raised among non-Jews and didn't know anything about Judaism, and you can't blame them for what they did wrong. But here, I think it's fairly well known that Judaism doesn't accept homosexuality. I don't think anyone can claim ignorance in this regard. There is an argument to be made that this person fits into the halachic category of mumar l'teavon. Mumar is someone who rejects Jewish law. Teavon is desire. A person who says, I believe in Judaism, I believe in God, I'm not interested in angering God, and I'm not interested in throwing everything away, but I have this compelling desire for X. And such a person counts for a minyan. Such a person is not drummed out of the community. So I think that category is the more reasonable of the categories to apply. But this person, however you read it, whichever technical category you use, should not be chased away and should not be made to feel ill, you know, to feel like there's something wrong with them. That's, number one, it's not true, you know, as I hope we've demonstrated. But number two, why would you want people to lose the connection that they have? That's a terrible thing. And to my mind, what the Torah is expecting of the Jewish community is to help, not to harm. That's what I would hope for. One last point. I realize that we're getting very late here, but one last point, and then I'll stick around for a bit with for further questions and discussion. But it's very important to realize within Judaism that we value diversity. Whether we live it is another story, but it's supposed to be valued. The tribes, it's actually the Torah portion for this coming week, the tribes of Israel, when they're traveling in the wilderness from Egypt into Israel, each has its own flag. We don't have them all travel under the same banner. There's a classic midrash about the Arba Minim on Sukkot. You're supposed to take the lulav, the etrog, the hadas, the arava, right, the different species, and wave them around in the different directions. And the midrash on that says each one represents a different kind of Jew, in the sense that there are some who have the mitzvot and they have the Torah, and there are some who have just they excel in this area, not in that area, and some people excel in no area. However, if you take the etrog, which is the one that has everything, if you take four etrogim and you recite a blessing on it, you know what that's called? A bracha levatala, a blessing in vain. You have to take all the species together. Without it, it's not a mitzvah. You need to have them all together. And I bring you one last note. Take a look at source number 19. Passage from the Jerusalem Talmud, talking about great verses in the Torah. Verse, it is written, love your neighbor as yourself. We've heard that one. Rabbi Akiva commented, this is a great overarching principle in the Torah. Ben Azai taught, this is the book of the genealogy of man. Man was created in the image of God. Also a verse in the Torah. This is an even greater overarching principle. He liked that verse even more. So there are various explanations as to why he felt that was better than love your neighbor. But one in particular on this passage is brought in a commentary called Siyun Yerushalayim, in which he says, because the text says man is created in the image of God, meaning that Elohim, this word that we use for God, actually means gods, multiple. Right? The word Elohim is plural, because it's meant to convey the God who possesses all powers. All powers are within him. God appears to be many to us, even though God is actually one. And what the Tzion Yerushalayim writes is that the same thing is true for human beings. We appear to be varied and different than many, and one person isn't like the next. But we have to recognize fundamentally that we're not. It's all one. We're all one person. And therefore we have that responsibility, playing off of what he said and the other sources that we brought, to value the diversity that we have, which is supported in other passages in the Talmud. We could have a whole class on that. But to value that diversity in people, and certainly not to alienate and make somebody feel like they are less than. To honor the commitment to God, as well as our commitment to each other. So for anyone who wants to leave, you may. I'm going to stick around. But thank you very much for participating in this series. Hold on for a second. I think this question has to be made before people run out. But I'll also note, I sent out an email about the series in June, July. It's a free series, and I hope that you'll be able to be there. It's Jews in Politics. And Arlene, go ahead.